In this, the second hour of our show, we'll be talking about organized labor, and particularly looking at what happened late last month, at the annual convention of the AFL-CIO in Chicago. At that gathering, the leader of one of America's biggest unions, that's the Service Employees International Union, announced that his members were pulling out of the AFL-CIO, and they were followed by some others, including the Teamsters and the United Food and Commercial Workers. It led to people to ask a lot of questions about the future of organized labor and whether, as a result of this major split here in the umbrella organization, whether, in fact, labor would be hurt or, in the long run, might possibly become stronger. We'll talk a little bit this morning about what happened recently and also what's happening in the world of organized labor in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Bob Bruno. He is associate professor in the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations at the University of Illinois. And in his research is particularly interested in political action and strategic campaigns by unions, among other things. He's also interested in media coverage of unions. He's the author of two books, one titled Reforming the Chicago Teamsters, the Local 705 Story, and the other is Steel Worker Alley, How Class Works in Youngstown. He's published articles in many journals, including Workplace Democracy, Labor Studies Journal, and Labor History. He's taught many industrial relation courses to trade union members working in all kinds of occupations, in the public, in the private, professional occupations. He hosts a cable show called Illinois Labor Works on a Chicago public access channel, and he is a frequent commentator on labor relations for both regional and national media. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana for people who'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you want to give us a call, you can do that. Again, here locally, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Bruno, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
You bet.
We appreciate it. Let's start out by talking a little bit about what happened here in Chicago last month. Apparently, the leader of this major defection from the AFL-CIO was Andrew Stern, who was the head of the Service Employees International Union, who had, I guess, for some time been complaining about the leadership of the AFL-CIO and believed that the strategy should change. And he also believed that the president, Mr. Sweeney, John Sweeney, should resign. So what was it that Mr. Stern was wanting the AFL-CIO to be doing that it wasn't doing?
Primarily, President Stern wanted the AFL-CIO to transform itself from the political lobbying arm that it has historically been into a organizing machine, one that would provide much greater incentive and resources to help organize labor, increase its members substantially by rather large numbers. And the types of changes that Stern was looking for would have required shifting a fair amount of power that has historically resided within the international affiliates, some 57 in the AFL-CIO, upward to the umbrella organization. Giving them the power really to have much greater influence and control over the organizing efforts of the affiliates. And there was a debate that ensued for about 9 months over the proper powers of the AFL-CIO, the importance of organizing to the labor movement, models of how that best should be done, and the amount of resources that should be invested in it. And at the end of the day, after the rather 9 months of debate and given back and forth between many union leaders, Stern decided that the changes that the Fed had agreed to simply didn't go far enough, and decided that he wanted to take his union and some other unions in a different direction. And as you say, on the eve of the convention, announced the pullout. And there was, as you say, a dispute over who would perhaps best lead the Federation, and over that 9-month period, the importance of Mr. Sweeney himself. itself kind of ebbed and flowed as various proposals were put forth. But ultimately, President Stern felt that John Sweeney, who had been, of course, his mentor for many years at the Service Employees Union, simply did not have the same commitment to the changes that Stern wanted, and without leadership change at the Fed, things weren't going to get significantly better.
Well, you anticipate my next question, because it was going to be about the relationship between Stern and Sweeney. As you say, Andrew Stern was a protege of John Sweeney, and that, in fact, John Sweeney at one time was himself the president of the Service Employees International Union. So it is this, in some sense, personal, a matter of the personal relationship between the two, or something of a power struggle? Because clearly it seemed that in the comments that John Sweeney made after this happened, that's the spin that he was putting on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that whenever there are large institutions engaged in rather serious battle in a crisis environment, and you know, make no mistake about it, that is the context for this debate. It's just probably impossible to avoid some of the back and forth becoming a personal struggle. Without doubt, Sweeney reacted as if a favorite child of his had expressed disloyalty and turned against the father. And Sweeney did express for him rather significant emotion and anger over the split. However, I think it would be a mistake to collapse this debate into nothing more than a disagreement between these two individuals or a power struggle between the two. And I would just submit as one small piece of evidence of that. At no time during the 9-month debate, frankly, did Stern put himself forward as a successor to Sweeney. And at different points throughout the debate, particularly early on, Stern was very complimentary of Sweeney and spoke more about turning the ship around, much more so than having a different captain at the helm. However, by the end of the 9-month period, it was pretty clear that the two men were no longer now on speaking terms. But frankly, there's probably greater animosity between President Stern and Gerald McAtee at the Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees than there is between Sweeney and Stern.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, and we'll get into that, because these two are in competition for organizing new members,
yeah.
Particularly in the service as service workers, and these are the people that I know. When people talk about what's the potential for growth in union membership, a lot of folks like this, they're pointed to as an important target audience, and I think a lot of people are expecting that the Service Employees International and AFSCME are going to be going toe to toe fighting between themselves to see who it is that's going to get to try to sign up these kind of people.
Yes, they do have common constituencies in the service sector, particularly amongst public sector workers and most recently in the healthcare field, and both unions did lock horns in a nasty struggle here in Illinois in the past year over home healthcare workers, and they continue to repeat that struggle in the state of Iowa and particularly in California. And one of the, and I'm sure we'll get into this discussion, but one of the biggest dangers of this split, of course, will be that these two large unions, the largest union in the Change to Win coalition, that the group, that, the name by which the group calls themselves, that split from the Fed, and the largest union that remains inside the Federation, AFSCME, are, you know, unless they come to some common ground as to how they will compete for non-union workers, they could be spending much more resources focusing on bidding up on each other than on taking on recalcitrant and abusive employers, and that would be a real negative result of this split.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guests for anyone who might have just joined us. We're talking with Bob Bruno. He is associate professor in the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations at University of Illinois and is a frequent commentator on labor relations for both the regional and national media. And we're talking a little bit this morning about what's been happening recently, some of the recent battles that have taken place within organized labor and what that means for the future of labor. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. For a moment here, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about what this split means for the AFL-CIO. Obviously, here they're going to be losing literally millions of members and the dues that those people pay. So, from that perspective, it would seem that this is a serious blow. Is it?
It is. It is certainly a serious blow, and there's a real loss of resources when these unions hold on to the cap payments that they would normally be making to the Fed. When you take about a third of the membership outside the AFL-CIO, it presents certainly various difficulties in developing coherent unitary strategies, both politically and economically, and it does present a real challenge to those unions that remain in the Federation to continue to act in really in a functional way, and they have plans to sort of think through how they find additional resources. Under John Sweeney, there really has been an effort to streamline in the last, well, really going back to the beginning of the debate, the Fed's operations. So they were sort of prepared. They have been preparing for the eventuality of this. And at the convention, they did talk about ways that they would raise additional revenue so that the loss is not too significant. But clearly, the Federation strength is based on size. It's based on numbers, and it's based on resources, particularly when it comes to being effective in state capitals and in Washington. And it's going to have to be very creative in how it manages its budget. Of course, all of this can be mitigated if, in fact, internally the unions that remain a part of the Federation are more effective, or first of all, more committed to organizing, and then are more effective in doing that. Because if the unions that remain inside the Fed grow their membership, they will very quickly replace the revenues that have been lost, and you could conceivably then have a Federation just as big as it is now a few years down the road if they successfully organize. But in the short run, obviously, this is a significant hit to the Federation's bottom line.
Mm-hmm. As you explained, and as I'm sure people probably will know if they've heard some of the coverage or read some of the coverage, perhaps the chief complaint of the insurgents, the people who split, was that they felt that more emphasis needed to be put on organizing and perhaps less on lobbying and cultivating members of Congress. Now, it is my understanding, though, that at least during the time that Mr. Sweeney had been president of the AFL-CIO, a membership indeed had gone up fairly significantly. Maybe two questions. How much do you think a membership could grow, and do you think that it is indeed a fair kind of criticism of the Federation that the union and its leadership spent too much time lobbying and trying to cultivate members of Congress and didn't put enough resources into the really what is one of the most basic bottom line activities that a union is going to have, and that is trying to attract new members?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what people who are listening should understand is that what the Federation is best equipped to do, and what it's most expected to do, and has historically always prioritized, was not to function as an organizing arm, but was to be the political face and the political arm of a united labor movement, and they weren't doing that particularly well in the periods leading up to the election of John Sweeney, but from roughly 1995 through the 2004 election cycle, President Sweeney and the Fed did a magnificent job in reinvigorating labor's political mobilization machine. And while there wasn't necessarily a that the labor movement had become again politically relevant. They had contributed larger sums of money. They had turned more foot soldiers out on election day. There was a change in how many unions did politics. They were no longer simply writing checks to the National Democratic Committee, but now they were simply going at candidates and looking for candidates to sign various pledges to support a working family's agenda. So on that basis, the Federation actually succeeded at what its predecessors had always expected it to do, and probably did it better historically than any other. Now, when it comes to organizing, Sweeney and the Fed also developed various strategies and plans and programs to help the affiliates organize. They encouraged greater mobilization around organizing. They encouraged training. They created an organizing institute at the headquarters of the Fed. They created various summer programs to train students and to train seminarians. And so they put together a rather elaborate structure to assist with organizing. The problem is that the Fed has absolutely no power to get any of the affiliates to follow the plan, so that if affiliates choose not to use the Fed services, there's nothing that can compel them to do that. And as a result, in the 10 years that John Sweeney and his leadership was in office, despite the positions that they took and the outreach efforts, in only one of those 10 years did organized labor see any kind of net growth. So there were 9 years of net loss in terms of union density. And while there was a small increase in the number of unions that were committing up to 30% of their resources to organizing, and that was the goal that Sweeney and the Fed were targeting. And by the way, that's a goal that grew out of Andy Stern's service employees. 10 years ago, the service employees was the only union that was spending 30% of its budget on organizing. And the goal of the next 10 years was to try to get many, 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 many more unions to do so. However, only a handful of additional unions ever did it. So the sad truth is most of the affiliates failed to seriously organize. And therefore, a lot of the debate and a lot of the struggle is really not about what the Fed did. It's about what the affiliates did poorly. But how can we change the leadership of the labor movement to bring about the kind of unions that we want? And therefore, Stern wanted an AFL-CIO, which would function with a great deal more authority in compelling change than what the present AFL-CIO leadership was willing to accommodate.
Let's talk with the caller. We have someone in Champaign County to start us off. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted you to talk about the follow-on to the conference. There was one thing that was contested was that Stern announced that, and I think some of the other unions, that they would keep cooperation at the council level, at sort of more at the grassroots, and that would be an indication that they would be able to still collaborate on many issues, including electoral. There was going to be a decision about that a couple days after the conference. I heard Sweeney take a really hard line saying, yeah, you're out. And yeah, I gather that is probably the way it's going to go. I think you're saying yes. I wanted you to comment on that. And then I'm affiliated with service employees, but I think somebody needs to light a fire under the unions, but the kind of unions that have gone on to this movement for change coalition, like the carpenters. I mean, the carpenters are having a rank-and-file revolt because they've gone to piecework in California. It's been just an awful thing, undercutting their previous wage scale and accusations of collaboration with major developers. And so, you know, it doesn't speak well for change from the top. So those couple issues.
Sure. Really good points. The first point about the possibility that there would be collaboration between the two groups, and as the caller correctly said, that coming out of the convention, President Sweeney's position was there would be simply no way that these dissenting unions could continue to work in any kind of cooperative way at the county or state or local level, that they would be clearly outside of the Federation's structure. However, just yesterday, Sweeney announced that he was sending a proposal to the AFL-CIO Executive Council to create what are called solidarity charters that would allow any of the dissenting locals that wanted to remain part of central labor councils or state federations to charter with those intermediate bodies to pay what would be their normal cap payment, and then to be charged an additional 10% solidarity fee. And this grew out of actually voices from both camps saying that they would like to see collaboration at the state and local level. Now it remains to be seen whether this proposal will be attractive to those dissenting unions. I'm not sure whether the 10% solidarity fee will be seen as some sort of penalty, because it is in addition to what their normal cap will be. But at least there's now been some movement away from Sweeney's initial no to any relationship. On the latter point, the caller is exactly right. I mean, there are a number of unions now that are outside the Fed, and they're not all outside the Fed, perhaps for the same reason. Internally, they govern in different ways, and not always in ways that have been approved. And the carpenters have gone through a rather a dramatic change and have restructured where power is in the union. It has generated a carpenters dissenting caucus that has tried to capture back what they think is some of the sort of democratic elements of their union. And if this separate group is really going to make some positive change, it's probably going to have to do a lot of work also internally. So nothing that we've seen happen in any way relieves the duty of rank and file union members within these unions to essentially create the kind of unions that they want. They weren't perfect unions inside the Fed. They're not perfect unions outside the Fed. And lots of work still needs to be done, and any kind of work that the unions are engaging in that might be undercutting wage rates is something that's going to cause a serious backlash. So there is a lot of internal work to do. The one thing they agree on is that they all want to organize members to a much larger amount, and felt a little bit restrained in doing so with inside the Federation. But in other respects, there's lots of things these unions disagree with.
Yeah, I think it's important to note for people who don't follow it so closely is that the carpenters actually pulled out, what was it, last summer?
They've been out actually for a few years.
Uh-huh.
The interesting thing is, despite the fact that they've been outside the Federation, they have continued to remain a part almost everywhere and a pain, a part of the Central Labor Councils and the State Federations of Labor. In other words, while they were outside the Fed at the international level, they continued to work collaboratively with other AFL-CIO unions as a pain affiliate of the intermediate bodies. So frankly, they've been out, but they haven't been that far out.
Well, they called that correctly in that they're so ensconced in the building trades parts of the councils that I think that they were seen as too fundamental. But this business about piecework per stud payment and all this stuff undercutting, if that's a champion of union change, then I think we need to look somewhere else. And there was another thread there, but I think I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Some other rank and filers call in.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. We're at a midpoint here in this second hour of Focus 580. And again, let me introduce our guest. We're talking with Bob Bruno. He is associate professor in the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations at University of Illinois. And in his research, is particularly interested in union political action, also governance and strategic campaigns. He's author of two books and many articles on the subject of labor. He's taught many industrial relations courses to trade union members working in public, private, and professional occupations. It is a frequent commentator on labor relations for both regional and national media. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, in a lot of the articles that I have been reading about what has been happening here lately, and particularly this split within the Federation, people draw comparisons to the time in the 1930s when a faction split from the American Federation of Labor and formed the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. They recruited literally millions of new members. And then in 1955, the two of them came back together. So that's when we now have the AFL-CIO. It was a stronger body and organized labor was stronger for it. And I said, and some people raise this question. The big question here is, well, what does this split mean for organized labor? Some people say, well, could it be that we could see a kind of scenario playing out here similar to this one that we saw back in the 1930s, and maybe this might, in fact, be good for organized labor in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that has been a feature of a lot of the discussion, and I certainly have contemplated it a great deal and joined in that discussion. And I think that there is an argument to be made, and others have made it, that in 1955, when the AFL and the CIO united, that it's at that point where you begin to see a reduction in labor activism, particularly in the areas of organizing. And that's very slowly but steadily you see a reduction in the percentage of workers who are unionized, and some would argue that the labor movement in 1955 lost some of its creativity and frankly some of its militancy, became too cooperative with the employer and ultimately grew a little lazy and fat from past successes, that the merger itself took away some of the edge in the labor movement that generated a kind of healthy competition and various models of representing workers, so that it's the merger that really begins this sort of slow decline. Now, of course, there are plenty of other villains in the story, plenty of other things that are happening to the economy and politically to address that. The loss of union membership, but the argument has been made that merging the unions ultimately was not in the best interest of the labor movement. And going back to the two decades before the merger, there was a period of tremendous unionization, and both groups, the AFL and the CIO, working in initially different labor markets, addressing themselves to different workers and appealing to workers in different ways. Both benefited from the competition, and the competition at times was somewhat cutthroat and unhealthy. But ultimately, after two decades, the two groups began to look a lot like each other, and the labor movement grew substantially. And in some ways, the split now does look similar in that the CIO was formed initially by actually fewer unionized members than are part of the Change to Win group, but it was formed because they correctly saw that the economy had so dramatically shifted, and at that time it was shifting, of course, to this great manufacturing economy, and that it was going to be necessary to organize workers in a different way, to organize them industrially, within industrial sectors, and that these union members were going to be different. They were going to be recent immigrants. They were not necessarily going to come from Western European countries. Some were going to be skilled, but many were going to be factory operatives and tenders. And so they picked up on a wave, a historical change, and created an organizational means to respond to them. Andy Stern has made the argument that the same kind of shift has occurred. Now the labor movement's been a little slow in reacting to it, but again, there's been this dramatic shift towards information technology and towards a service economy, and therefore we need to have a different model for attracting workers in that sector to unionism, that one size doesn't fit all, and that we need a new model and a new approach, and if that's correct, and we're successful at doing that, then we would see growth, further growth in healthcare, further growth in the service sector, further growth in information technology, and that added union membership will feed back into those areas that have suffered, like manufacturing and retail trade and transportation, and that perhaps, again, one can't be certain, but perhaps in another 10 or 20 years, the growth has occurred, and now once again the two unions have found common ground, and they merge down the road as a much stronger and new 21st century labor movement. A lot of it's theoretical and speculative, but I think there's some argument to be made that this is not necessarily the end of the labor movement, that it might be a new beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find this really fascinating because, as you say, I think that a lot of people would explain this decline in union membership as explainable partly by this change in the economy, as the unions traditionally in the past had really concentrated on organizing these people who worked in heavy industry. And as those industries have declined, so has the percentage of people, at least in the private sector, who belong to unions has declined. And then, again, some people have said, well, we have this other sector of the economy that's growing in importance. That's where we should be working, which gets us back to this conversation we were having before about the competition between the service employees and AFSCME in trying to organize people who work in service, who are in many cases women, minority women, and people who already are in jobs where they're very low paid, and I imagine they don't get much in the way of benefits and so forth. I was really interested to see in a story, you're quoted in a story in the Washington Post, in fact, looking at this very issue of organizing people in the service industry, and in fact, looking at what's going on here in Illinois among the efforts to organize people who work in child care.
Correct.
And saying that here, this gives us a great case study of what's going on with this split within the Federation, and maybe in a larger sense, a way of talking about what's happening within the whole world of organized labor.
Well, that's right. You know, the labor movement historically has been, when it's been most effective and when it's been seen by workers as a meaningful agent for improving the conditions of their lives, when it has been responsive to where work has been created, and that it has essentially followed the work. And now that we're in this service economy, although I want to underscore that there are still thousands of manufacturing jobs out there, most of them are now non-unionized, particularly in auto parts, for example. So there's still lots of unionized efforts that could go on in the industrial sectors, but clearly the massive growth has been in the service economy. It's and in public sector, and it is terribly underunionized. And these workers are, to a great extent, women. To a great extent, they are people of color. To a great extent, there is less formal education, and they have, as you say, very few benefits and very low pay. So it's not only a change in where work's being done, and of course the tools in which that work is being done, and it's not only calling out for different models of organizing, but it's presenting the possibility of different kinds of workers being unionized, and that goes really also to the heart of what the labor movement means to be to people, and will it be historically a kind of old unionism that looks white and Eastern and Western European, or will it look like a unionism that is really this sort of multicultural mix? Now, the leaders of the service employees, the leaders of AFSCME, are principally white men, ironically enough, but their memberships are overwhelmingly of the work population that is growing rapidly and growing the fastest. And interesting enough, the group within the non-union workforce that's most likely to join a union, the most likely person to join a union is an African-American woman working in a service sector. The most unlikely person to join a union is a white male, between 30 and 45, working in a manufacturing sector. These are important considerations, and therefore this split can have really revolutionary impacts on the way the labor movement looks and responds, how it looks in the future, and particularly how well it's responding to the economy and whether or not this is going to work or not. So it really kind of goes to the heart of the changes in the economy.
Let's talk with some other callers here. We have someone here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wondered if you'd comment on maybe the statement that was made at the time of the split that it was becoming ineffective to throw money at the politicians. And it seems like the Democratic Party is really distancing itself from labor, and I was really struck by the fact that the first Democratic governor we've had here in years is the one who raids the pension funds for the state. And I wonder if you have anything to say about that.
Sure. Of course, the biggest fear that the Democratic Party in this country has is that this split is going to mean that the trough is going to be shut off, or at least the money's going to flow a little bit slower. I think the critique that the Democratic Party has not been a labor-friendly party, and therefore a kind of uncritical support of the party is kind of like pouring bad money after bad. And I think that's a very fair critique. It goes too far, however, to say that politics isn't important and that you can't continue to act as a political institution. It's probably a bit ironic that the two largest labor union political action committees that are contributing to the Democratic Party are the service employees, now outside the Fed, and AFSCME, inside the Fed. And both are politically active, both in this state and around the country. So it's sort of a straw argument to assume that if you organize, you can't do politics, and if you do politics, you can't do it. You obviously have to do both. But I think when Stern commented, frankly, not only at the convention, but also during the 2004 presidential election, that if John Kerry were to get elected, it might actually slow down the revitalization of the labor movement. While it may have been not politically correct to say such a thing, I think it actually suggested a truth, and that is that labor has found themselves stuck with a party that was once much more supportive, much more clearly supportive of organized labor and working families, and has now become a much more centrist and capital-friendly party. And labor's had very little, has shown very little courage or effort to alter that political perspective. So that while you have to continue to be active politically, I think it would serve the benefits of working people if the Democratic Party now has to think very hard and very seriously about appealing not just to the membership of the Fed, but to the 4 million or more union members that now are outside of the Fed and very politically active, and have to think real hard about their policy positions. It might ultimately have some impact on bringing the party back towards its more liberal pro-labor position.
Well, thank you. I agree with most of what you're saying, and it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, because if labor doesn't have the numbers, you know, if we don't continue to grow, we're not going to get any respect. So thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to someone else here on a cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Very interesting. Just a quick comment. You don't reckon that the unions have served their purpose and this is just part of a trend in the other direction?
You mean in the other direction, that just the need for? Yeah. You know, if only that were true, but, you know, frankly, what we know from a lot of independent studies indicate that some of the, you know, some of the worst conditions, for example, of the marketplace have reoccurred. Studies have shown that there is now a reoccurrence of sweatshop labor in Chicago. You know, the increased numbers of people without health insurance or without any sort of secured pension all, you know, speak to the need for some kind of collective representation. if in fact we had an economic system and a marketplace, or if you had the political means to provide people with the kinds of benefits, for example, that occur in a national healthcare system in Canada, or that occur in European political systems, or you had a marketplace that, frankly, was going to be much more generous in equalizing the benefits of change, then you know you could make a case that maybe historically what was once needed is no longer needed. But frankly, the evidence suggests that the economic pressures on workers are as great now as they have been, certainly since the post-war years, and we don't really have any sort of public policy that can substitute for achieving these benefits in the workplace. And as long as our, for the most part, if you think about it, if most of our benefits grow out of that sort of, you know, define what it means to live a quality life, grow out of our relationship with the employer, unless all of our employers are going to all of a sudden turn into saints, and of course many are in fact very good people but feel compelled for economic reasons to act as they do, it's going to be necessary to have some kind of collective representation. Now, maybe in addition to unions, something that could be thought about, something that's very prevalent in European countries, are other workplace bodies, things called work councils, that allow for a kind of cooperative working together of labor and management, and the union serves as a body that sort of that defines a kind of cost of labor, but there's much more to talk about in terms of efficiency through these work councils. So maybe there are some alternatives that could be added on, but frankly, I just don't see that things have changed so much so that workers no longer need unions. In fact, based on research that the AFL-CIO has done, anywhere from 37 to 57 million additional workers would like to join a union, and many of those are in areas, sectors that you would never think would be so interested in unionization if two things were true. One, they felt the union would be meaningful, that it could actually make a difference because they see a need for it, and two, if they didn't fear that they'd lose their job as a result of a boss.
I've been on both sides, and contrary to what most people believe, these companies or businesses are not getting rich, and they're not doing it on the backs of the workers.
Mm-hmm.
And in our little town here, we've lost a lot of jobs that are never going to come back because nobody would give.
Mm-hmm.
And the management of the company owner, which gives opportunities to the workers, just had enough. And we're losing them, and they're not coming back. And the union will not give, and is just making this town a ghost town. And now we have minimum wage or, a fast food job, and that will not work.
What town are you from?
Mattoon.
I'm sorry?
Mattoon.
Oh, I see. And, I grew up in a community that was once a great steel center in Youngstown, Ohio. And, by the end of the 70s, mid part of the 1980s, lots of really good paying unionized steel jobs had disappeared. And, in retrospect, there was some blame to go around. The union could not, of course, agree to allow management to sweat the labor or exploit the labor. Yet at the same time, the union probably didn't accurately understand the competitive pressures that many steel firms were now facing as a result of global competition. And I have heard union leaders, and you may take some solace in that, look back on that time and say, frankly, we made mistakes. We should have been aware of the need to kind of prepare for a kind of orderly downsizing, and we probably should have looked to make concessions in different ways so that we could preserve work here. I think it is true that not every company that goes bankrupt or moves south or that asks for concessions is without need. I do think, however, that even with those conditions, somebody still has to, the shareholders, the stockholders, and the board of directors are looking out for the company. Somebody still has to look out for the workers. And it's probably not accurate to say in any situation that the employer can have the same degree of sensitivity to those interests as the workers themselves. That doesn't mean you have to have a hostile relationship. There are other models around the world, and maybe you're looking for a different model, and I would certainly like to see some change myself.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks
thank
for the
you.
Call. One of the things that I wanted to take up, and we have maybe about 5 minutes left, has to do with the way we explain the decline in union membership. And I know that there are some people who say that, and particularly I think take the media to task for the way they report labor issues, and say that a major factor is hostility of employers toward organizing their workers, and that they actively work against the organizing of workers, and that the government is not doing what it should in protecting the rights of workers to organize.
Yeah, and there's certainly strong evidence that supports that. One piece of evidence is that, and this comes from data from the National Labor Relations Board, in 2004, when we have the best data, 10,000 workers were fired from jobs because they attempted to organize a union. 10,000. Now, that may not seem like an incredibly large number given all the numbers of workers out there, but if you think about 10,000 workers losing their job because they tried to practice a right that they believe they had under law, and what the chilling effect of that is to those other workers in that workplace, it does really bring into question whether or not that effective right exists. And historians and labor relations experts have pointed out that of all the democratic industrialized countries in the world, the United States has had the most violent and most hostile labor relations. Strikes go on longer. Employers are more resistant. More resources are put into creating industries to avoid unionization, both law firms and consultants, than in any other democratic industrialized nation. There is a bill in Congress right now called the Employee Free Choice Act that would attempt to modify the National Labor Relations Act and would give workers a little bit more protection. And, of course, this ebbs and flows. Under Democrats, that right is a little better protected. And, frankly, now under Republicans, although it wasn't always this way, but under the current class of Republican leadership, that right is very, very often undermined and crippled. So that is a very serious concern. It's an obvious fact, and it needs to be addressed. And that goes back to one of the things one of the callers said earlier. That's going to require some political change. And right now, there simply hasn't been enough of support in Congress to make something like that happen. But yes, that's a major concern and a problem that we face here that they frankly don't face. Workers don't face in Canada, for example, where the law is much more protective of organizing rights.
We'll try and get one more caller in here. I'll have to ask the caller to be quick, but we'll do that. They're in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Earlier you talked about union leaders feeling that they had missed the boat, at least in Youngstown and elsewhere in the steel industry, by not taking into account the problems of management. But in the clothing industry, at least in the New York area, the unions did just that. They made concessions and formed committees and so on with the employers, and that led to labor being the lowest paid, that is, the garment workers union being the lowest paid among all the unions in the area and in the country, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only way out, and still the industry moved overseas, and there's practically nothing left of the old garment workers.
Right.
Of the old garment industry in New York City. Everything is slave labor now, essentially, below minimum wage.
Yeah, we I got to get a comment here from the guest because we're really short on time.
I'll make it quick. That's a great point, and it's really a question whether or not concessions ever really make a difference. Not only did it not save the garment industry, but it certainly hasn't done anything really to protect workers in the airline industry, which have asked for concession after concession after concession. So if capital wants to move and it can find cheap labor somewhere, it's very hard, it seems to me, for organized labor to work cheap enough to keep the work here.
I must jump in. My apologies for kind of cutting off the caller there, but I'm afraid I just had to do that because we've come to the end of the time. We will have to leave it at that, with our thanks to our guest, Bob Bruno. He is Associate Professor in the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations at the University of Illinois. And Professor Bruno, thanks very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Dave.